Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our guest once again is Peter Schiff. Peter is the CEO of Euro Pacific Capital and best-selling author of The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. He also is host of the nationally syndicated Peter Schiff Show, heard daily from 1 to 3 Pacific Time at schiffradio.com. Peter, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me on again.
Question about the subject that's near and dear to most of my clients' hearts is real estate. We are investors in California, and I know you think that real estate is overpriced here. It depends, and I guess that's why I'm going to ask you. We have a county that I live in, Riverside, where the prices still are so low that a builder couldn't possibly create a building lot and build a house for a profit. Does that make it underpriced, or is it still overpriced?
Yeah, well, certainly, I mean, California, I guess, is not one market. There are probably many local markets within the state. It's a big state.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that property prices, right, are below the construction cost is an indication that at least the market in that particular area might not be as overvalued as it is in some areas. But, you know, in many cases, that depends on what the land is being valued at. I mean, the land might actually be worthless in that respect.
It is.
The only value is the improvement. But, of course, the improved property does depreciate over time. So if it's there, if it's being used, it's also wearing out. And so you're kind of, if you can't really sell it, you're going to have to factor in the depreciation until there's a point where maybe you could. Because I think a lot of the people that in California during the bubble, when, the markets that were, you know, more on the coast than, you know, associated with, you know, the bigger major cities, as a lot of people were getting priced out of the market, they started to stretch into these, you know, a distant inland empire type markets where maybe they had an hour commute, but they thought it was worth it because it was the only way they can get into the real estate game, and they wanted to get rich, and so they figured they'd endure the long commute. But now that the bubble has burst, there's really no reason to live so far away from where you work, especially with the higher cost of gasoline now. Making it so expensive to get to work, assuming you still even have a job. And so I think that more people would rather rent something closer to work than buy something an hour away, you know, even if it's a bargain based on what it might cost to build it. Because maybe there's no reason to build it. You know, a lot there's been a lot of property. You know, you can build a house in the desert and say, well, you know, it's selling for a lot less than it cost me to build. Yeah, because you're an idiot for building it, because there's no reason to have that house in the middle of the desert. You know, who's going to want to live there? So in some respects, you can't just say, well, it's selling below construction costs, because maybe it shouldn't have been constructed. And maybe it's going to have to go down a lot more before it makes sense for people to buy it. But, you know, usually when you think of California, you think about, you know, San Francisco Bay Area, the Los Angeles area, Orange County. And there, I think prices are still way out of whack with people's ability to pay. I think the only reason that people are still able to afford these high prices is because of massive government subsidies. I mean, right now we have the lowest interest rates, mortgage rates ever in the history of the country. And that's what it's taking to prop up the real estate market. But not only that, not only do the interest rates have to be at record lows, but the Federal Reserve is buying $45 billion worth of mortgages a month. So without the Fed buying up the market, mortgage rates would be rising. The only reason they're not rising is because the Fed is buying them all. So the government is directly loaning money to people to buy houses at the lowest mortgage rates in history, and that's the only thing holding up the market. But eventually, the Fed has to take away the punch bowl. Interest rates have to go up, which means mortgage rates have to go up, which means real estate prices have to plunge. Because once interest rates go up, people can't afford to buy these houses at these inflated prices. And I think the other problem for California is, you know, the fact that the jobs are going to go. I mean, the entrepreneurs, no businessman in their right mind is going to move a business into California, whereas plenty of entrepreneurs are planning their escape from California. I talk to people all the time that are planning to move to Nevada or someplace else, get out of California. You have governors. You have Rick Perry from Texas. He almost lives in California now, recruiting California businesses to move from California to Texas. And when it's 13% income tax versus 0%, and you know, and it's not only that; it's the California Labor Board. I mean, it is very expensive and risky to hire people in the state of California. And if you manage to eke out a profit, you know, you've got this huge tax. So I think the tax base is going to be eroded. People are going to be leaving the state, not coming to the state. So that means more houses up for sale, not as many people there to buy them. So it's just, you know, it's just a disaster, you know, in the making for California real estate.
I don't think you're opposed to signing up for a 30-year payment at this level.
If you're going to own a house,
you're right.
If you own a house, you got to take advantage of the cheap money. I mean, I think the worst way to own real estate right now is to own it free and clear, to just own it all cash. Because I think the only way that you make money as a homeowner is by being a debtor. So you're not really making money on the value of your house going up. You're making money on the value of the debt being wiped out. And if you can buy a property for 3.5% down, which you can if you get an FHA loan, then you get a lot of leverage and you can take advantage of the, you know, the cheap financing. And when inflation wipes out all the savers, they wipe out the debtors, they wipe out your mortgage debt. So I definitely think that if you're going to own a house that you do it that way. But if you're looking at, you know, investing in property, I certainly wouldn't be buying in California. I mean, there might be places where the economies are likely to be better that you could look at. Maybe you could look at Texas real estate. But, you know, I think the national economy is still going to suffer because of the policies of coming out of Washington and out of the Federal Reserve that unfortunately affect everybody. Even if you're living in a state that's getting it right, you're still living in a country that's getting it very, very wrong.
So just in general, real estate is not a preferred asset really almost anywhere.
If I'm right about the U.S. economy heading for a major collapse, a financial crisis, a sovereign debt crisis, a dollar crisis, it's not a good market for real estate. I mean, people are losing their jobs. People are going to be spending more and more money on food and energy, so they're not going to have as much money left over for rents or mortgage payments. And I do think that households are going to be destroyed. I think a lot of young people, you know, think back to the late 1990s, 2000s. People were graduating from college. They got good jobs. They immediately bought a house. That's not going to happen anymore. People are graduating from college. They can't get jobs. They're drowning in student loans. There's no way they can afford a house. And why would they even want one? Because there's no longer a compelling reason to buy, because the reason to buy before was that you could get rich because the prices were going up. Now, people start to appreciate the cost of owning a house, that they're actually money pits. You have to pay property taxes, insurance, maintenance. You know, all this stuff costs money. People forgot about the cost of owning a house when prices were rising because it cost you nothing, because the appreciation offset all those costs and left money left over. But if houses aren't appreciating, if they're just, you know, keeping pace with inflation, it costs you a lot of money to own them. And so a lot of young people can't afford it. They don't want to. So you're not going to get that. You're also getting older people now who are retiring, but they don't have any income because they're getting 0% interest on their savings. They can't afford to stay in their homes. So they're putting their homes on the market for sale. They have to downsize because they don't have the income to sustain themselves. You've got lots of people leaving the workforce now. So you've got people who have to downsize. You have the young people that can't afford to buy, the old people that have to sell. I mean, so the supply and demand imbalance is going to be enormous. Plus, you've got all the backup and foreclosures. The whole process has been gummed up for years. There's huge shadow inventory of property that isn't on the market right now because people don't think they can sell. The minute people see some kind of uptick in prices, you're going to see a lot of property come right back on the market. And, of course, most of the property is not going to be able to sell because there's not enough buyers. And so it's not going to be a good, if you're really worried about inflation, you want to buy gold, you want to buy, you know, commodities, you want to buy foreign stocks. If you want to buy real estate, buy it in Asia. Buy some real estate in Hong Kong or Singapore or, you know, Shanghai, or even go to Australia, buy it there, or, you know, buy it someplace where the economy is going to improve, you know.
Peter, where do you live?
Connecticut.
Connecticut. Okay. Just curious. You own a home there?
I do, and I'm way underwater in it, even though I just bought it a couple years ago. You know, it's already, you know, and I, you know, I didn't buy it as an investment. I bought it because I was, you know, tired of moving. The landlord I had been, I rented it before I bought it.
Okay.
But I'll tell you this, I bought the property for about 60% below what the guy who sold it to me paid.
Okay.
And I'm still losing in it. It's still down because, you know, I spent money fixing it up and I probably, you know, lost about 70% of the money I improved, right? Whatever I spent improving the house, it's worth, you know, I got back maybe on the appraisal about 30% of the value that I spent. Plus the house went down anyway, even though I bought it. I bought it in December of 2009. So well after the market, but I bought it for half of what the price was in 2002.
Wow.
And the guy who sold it to me, he spent a lot of money on it too. He did things to fix it up. And so he really took a bath because he owned it for all those years. But, you know, I didn't buy it because I thought I was picking the bottom. I bought the house because I had enough money that I didn't care how much money I lost on the house. Because I own a boat, right? Now, that's a stupid financial decision. I mean, it's a complete, I use my boat maybe three or four times a year. I mean, for what it costs me to maintain that boat, I can rent a much better boat, you know, and save a lot of money every time I wanted a boat. But I don't own the boat as an investment. It's just a lifestyle. It's like, it's just something that I wanted to have, just like my cars. I buy cars. I know they're going to go down in value every year, but I buy them anyway. So that's the same attitude about a house. So that's why you shouldn't buy a house if you're not prepared to lose money. You know, if otherwise rent, because for most people, renting is cheaper. Brokers always try to con you into thinking that you're throwing away money if you're renting. You're not throwing away money on rent. You get a place to live out of it. You know, for years, I was renting houses, and I was paying my landlord such a low rate of rent that they were in negative cash flow. I was getting a great deal renting because I was avoiding all the headaches of owning a home. I mean, now that I own this home, which I do get enjoyment out of it, but I'm living in it. But it cost me a fortune. I mean, it's this stuff breaking all the time, even though the house was built in 2002. It's not like it's a really old house, but stuff is always going wrong.
It doesn't.
I mean, there's workers at the house every week fixing something.
It doesn't sound like I'm going to talk you into being a real estate investor anytime soon. That's for sure. You have a.
Well, it depends on where. You know, it depends on where the real estate is. But part of the problem is right now too is a lot of hot money has moved into the real estate market. There's a lot of private equity guys that have borrowed a lot of cheap money and have bought up all these single family homes. So a lot of the home sales that have taken place recently. It's not legitimate buyers. These are flippers. These are speculators that have bought these houses up. They're putting them up for rent, but they're hoping to sell them when the market comes up. But it's not going to work because when interest rates go up, the prices are going to come down, and they're going to start losing money on these houses because interest rates will go up. They borrowed the money to buy them. They're not going to collect enough in interest in rent to cover the interest on the borrowed money. And as the economy worsens, some of their tenants might lose their jobs. So I think you're going to see a glut of these spec homes coming out of the market. And these guys aren't, you know, these guys are levered up. But when their investors want their money, they're just going to sell. They're just going to hit the bids, you know. So you could see a big, big drop in prices because of all the spec money that's trapped in residential housing right now. Single family. You know, they didn't just buy apartments. They bought up huge blocks of single-family homes in Arizona, in Phoenix, in Nevada, Arizona, in Florida.
You know, in Riverside, where I live.
Yeah, I mean, and these, you know, they think they're going to make money. You know, they're trying to catch a falling knife. They're going to end up catching it right in their stomach.
You have a son, Spencer. How old is Spencer?
He's 10.
He's 10.
I got another son on the way too.
Oh, congratulations.
He's negative 3 months.
Okay. Well, Spencer's too young to have an opinion of what he's going to have to deal with yet, or maybe not. But you probably starts early in your household. Is he saving gold?
Yeah, well, no, I've got one book that I wrote that young people can really read and understand and enjoy. A lot of 10 and 11-year-olds have read it. It's called How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes. So if you have a young son, buy that book for him, and when he's finished reading it, read it yourself.
Okay. Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
You have a term that you use, decoupling. And explain that term, and how does that start, or has it already started?
Well, it's not really my term. I mean, it's kind of a term that a lot of people use to describe a situation where, you know, right now the global economy, if you think of the global economy as a train, and all the trains are attached to one another. And if one train, you know, moves, they all move, or one train slows down. And in that analogy, most people think of the U.S. as the engine, right? And you've got all these other trains. But the idea of decoupling is that a train can decouple from that engine and keep on going, right?
Mm-hmm.
That means that maybe the U.S. can stumble, but emerging markets can still do well. Now, my idea about decoupling is that the U.S. isn't the engine, it's the caboose, and that decoupling actually is going to benefit all the other cars. Because America isn't pulling the train is dragging America's dead weight. And the reason I say America represents a dead weight is because we're net importers. We consume more than we produce. That means we're living off the global economy. We're a net parasite. And I think that if America just disappeared, right, then the world would have more. The world would be able to work less or enjoy more consumption from the work that they're currently doing. They would have more, you know. And so I think that that kind of decoupling is going to be very positive. A lot of people think, oh, if the U.S. economy crashes, we're going to take the whole world down with us. I think it's the opposite. I think it's propping the U.S. economy up that's holding the whole world back. And if the world lets the dollar collapse and stops subsidizing our economy, their economies will take off.
Okay. You have a good question in the book. Will we default to avoid a crisis or react to one? Which do you think is going to occur?
Well, I don't think we are going to avert a crisis. I think that the only hope we have of eventually doing the right thing is doing it in the aftermath of a crisis. Because that goes to the nature of politics. Politicians, you know, they follow their own self-interest, their own need for preservation and to get reelected. So they're never going to deliberately do something to bring on short-term pain, even if it's exactly what's needed, right? They're not going to ask us to swallow medicine that tastes bitter, even if it's going to cure us, right? They'd rather give us some sugar, something that tastes good, just so they can get reelected, even if in the process the disease gets worse because we're not treating it. But once it comes to the point where it's so bad that they can't do that anymore, then they may finally be forced to do the right thing. But believe me, they will try everything else first.
It seems like the one suggestion of just giving a one-time tax of the wealthy certainly seems like the sentiment is leaning toward people that have tried to do well and have savings and so forth. Let's tap that spigot, tax it as hard as we can. That feels like a pretty dangerous trend.
Oh, yeah. I mean, simply confiscating wealth through a confiscatory tax plan is not going to solve any of our problems. First of all, whatever money the government confiscates, it's just going to spend it. So it's not like it's going to help the economy. But you also create a very dangerous precedent that, you know, what you own isn't yours, that the government can steal it. And so people will not be trying to accumulate more wealth. They'll be trying to hide whatever wealth they have out of the country. And so once you start that, I mean, you're pretty much finished. You know, what we need to do is restructure the debt by, you know, just simply not paying back what we've borrowed. And that's not confiscating anything. That's simply defaulting. I mean, individuals declare bankruptcy all the time, you know, and it doesn't mean that we're no longer a nation of laws, that we no longer have a market, because the market allows for bankruptcy. Look, Stockton, California just declared bankruptcy. You know, cities can declare bankruptcy when they're broke. Well, the U.S. government is broke, and there is no way to pay its bills. All we can do now is keep interest rates at zero, so we don't have to pay our bills. The Fed is printing $1 trillion a year, so we don't have to pay our bills. But this is damaging the economy much more than if we just defaulted. What we're doing now is far more dangerous to the economy than a legitimate restructuring of our debt, where we tell our creditors we can't pay you back. And what would immediately happen, if we were to default on our debt, nobody would want to loan us any more money, and that's a good thing. The best thing that can happen to America is that nobody wants to loan the U.S. government any money, because then the U.S. government has to stop spending. You know, I mean, if they can't borrow, they can't spend. And, of course, we have to tie the Fed's hands. We have to make sure that they can't print. Because right now the Fed is monetizing all this debt. They have to stop doing that. They have to stop giving the government an easy way out. We need a Fed chairman with some backbone to let interest rates go up and to refuse to monetize any of this debt. And that would force the government to cut spending. But because the Fed gives them an easy way out, they don't have to cut spending, because there's no immediate negative consequence to the budget deficits, because the Federal Reserve monetizes them. But that is creating grave long-term consequences. And I'm not talking about 10, 20 years from now. We're going to face these long-term consequences in the next few years.
When you mentioned Stockton, that's a real test case for a lot of people that have debt that are in line, CalIPERS being one of them, bondholders and so forth. And there was another event with Cyprus recently that probably makes people feel pretty uncomfortable with large deposits.
Oh, well, look, I mean, even small deposits, because remember, initially they talked about giving everybody a haircut, including the accounts that were insured. So if you've got a bank account in the United States, you are going to lose, right? One way or another, you're going to lose. Either your bank is going to fail and the government's not going to bail you out, and you're going to lose some of your deposits. Even if your account is insured, you still might lose. Because, you know, we have $8, $9 trillion worth of insured deposits. And the FDIC has about $20, $25 billion worth of treasuries to back them up. So that's nothing. So one scenario is your bank fails and there's no bailout and you lose. And you don't get back your money. You get back some of your money. Or the bank doesn't fail because the government bailed them out, or the bank fails and the government bails them out, and you get back all your money, but your money isn't worth anything because the government had to print trillions in order to bail everybody out. So either you lose to inflation or you lose to default. So the lesson is, don't maintain a large bank account. Just keep enough money to clear your rent check or your mortgage check, and don't keep any significant amount of money in the bank. You got to do something else with it. You got to invest it. You got to buy gold. You got to buy silver. Buy stocks. You can even buying real estate is better than leaving your money in the bank. But you know, you can. I like buying foreign stocks, buying dividend paying stocks. Do something with your money. You have to own something that the Federal Reserve can't print.
One of the hardest things about investing now is, because of all the manipulation and the interference, it's hard to say this is how it's going to play out in the short term, because it's so volatile because of the interference. And
yeah, there is a lot of noise. There are a lot of things that are happening to manipulate the market. And of course, we have foreign central banks, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of China, European Central Bank. We have banks all around the world, in emerging markets, in Latin America and Southeast Asia, that are all interfering to prop up the dollar. And all of this is delaying the day of reckoning. So it's impossible to know exactly when that day is going to arrive. The only thing we know for sure is that it will arrive. And the longer we have to wait, the worse it's going to be.
Peter, go ahead and give us your information again, please.
Well, my brokerage firm, if anybody's interested in learning about how to build a globally diversified portfolio of foreign stocks and bonds, talk to one of my brokers at Europe Pacific Capital. The website is europac.net, EUROPAC.net. If you want to buy physical precious metals, I have my own gold metal company. You can just go to Schiff Gold, S-C-H-I-F-F, gold.com. And, you know, if you want to listen to more of what I've got to say, I do that daily radio show on weekdays from 9 a.m. to, oh no, from California time, it would be 7 a.m. to 9 a.m., Monday through Friday at shiftradio.com. And, of course, if for some reason you're not listening to that early in the morning, I repeat the show every 2 hours. So you can just come to shiftradio.com whenever you want, and you can hear that two-hour show.
Well, Peter, again, I appreciate you joining us. The real crash, America's coming bankruptcy, is an interesting read, and a lot of thoughts popped into my head. So, Peter, thanks again for joining us.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.